Dear patrons, welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of the end of history. I'm Alex Hohili in São Paulo, Brazil. You probably knew that. And you also probably are aware of the fact that George Hoare is in London. And surprise, Philip Cunliffe is back in Canterbury after being away.
Hey. How's it going?
No, and welcome back, Phil, because like the last couple of episodes, at least we've recorded, has been just me or me and George. It's always
some excellent episodes.
Some excellent episodes. Purely
coincidental. They were missing. They were good, you know, but they were missing a certain something. You know, what was that something? What was that missing?
One of those things that makes something worse but is distinctive.
I don't know about that. I think it's maybe the thing that is called umami. It gives the flavor.
Umami.
Yes, I've been away, listeners. Those who follow me on Twitter, they might have seen I was traveling in the US for a couple of weeks, coast to coast, in fact. I was in San Francisco for an annual disciplinary convention that I used to attend almost every year, in fact, before lockdown. It was good to be back. And then I kind of trailed my way back east, doing some academic work en route and ending up in Princeton to celebrate the retirement of Richard Tuck, leading constitutional and political theorist. And it was, in fact, it was great because unexpectedly, but happily en route, I met a whole bunch of listeners I haven't had the chance to meet before in various contexts, some in California. Nice. And some in Princeton. And that was great. And it was great to kind of chat face to face to our listeners because it's an opportunity that arises really. So that was fantastic.
Someone even recognized you by this kind of grating noise. And they were like, oh, no, I recognize that voice. That's Phil.
I think it was what they, I can't quite recall what they said, but it might have been something like the dulcet tones of this highly kind of highly polished transatlantic accent that nobody can quite place where it is, but clearly speaks to somebody who is well-informed and, you know, has an exotic and interesting background.
Well, well done on your PMC travels, avoiding the ghastly flyover country.
It was, unfortunately, it wasn't quite that PMC because it was economy class the whole way. So I did actually have to suffer for it. So, you know.
Well, the PMC only flies economy class now. You know, this is the downward.
That's actually true.
Anyway, while you were away in Europe, I mean, we have maybe touched on this in the past, but notably the NatCon conference in Brussels was shut down by police after they'd been forced to change venues a couple of times. And I think just a few days before that, the Palestine conference, a kind of pro-Palestine solidarity conference in Berlin, was also kind of shut down by police. So I find this stuff really shocking, especially because it's not like, you know, the usual kind of thing that we'd be used to in terms of shutting, you know, abridging or, you know, clamping down on rights in terms of association or freedom of expression or whatever would be like maybe Islamic extremists. And it seems to me like increasingly it's stuff which is fairly mainstream, which is being,
You know, I mean, but it's also like these were a lot of the NatCon conference was like major EU kind of politicians involved, you know, both at the national level and at the continental level. And that was actually the same in the Berlin thing as well. This was quite kind of, it was quite striking.
Yeah, Varoufakis was banned from like speaking in Germany, right?
Yeah, you know, like
which I'm sure you were delighted about, Phil, because you're like, finally, they shut that guy up.
I don't support cracking down on Varoufakis' free speech. But if you wish to commit public harakiri as, you know, contrition for his terrible kind of effect on public life, the fate, the Greek people and European politics in general, he would have no objection from me. But
it's someone I invite him on the podcast actually to talk about techno feudalism. So
yeah, well, you know, let's see if he turns up. But yeah, we can say to Varoufakis quite happily that his free speech will be protected here. So if he's finding it a bit difficult in Germany and in the European Union that he worked so hard to defend and to prop up, you'll find perhaps some global podcasting land is a freer space. But this was, I mean, I know you wrote a piece on this, Alex, you know, but I suppose it's striking not only kind of the relative inoffensiveness, so to speak, of the, you know, Palestine solidarity and entirely kind of mainstream politics in the EU that was cracked down on, but also just, you know, across the Union as a whole, both ends of the political spectrum. And, you know, it's just a kind of a self-indictment of the European Union as a political project. You know, like looking from the outside in, why would anyone still think there's any kind of meaningful legitimacy in this institution that is descending into this kind of bizarre parody of centrist tyranny?
The alternative is fascism. That's it. You've got EU or fascism.
Well, clearly that's what they think, right?
It's not obviously the EU in terms of an institution. It's not the EU institutions making this decision. It was like, you know, mayors in Brussels and the police and whatever. So it's like national level politics. So, but obviously the point is that it's within the context of the European Union and it's a whole edifice.
Yeah, but it's the same
politics.
It's the same kind of politics at work in both places, right? And Brussels is the capital of this completely kind of, you know, clapped out, crumbling empire. You know, they're not, I'm sure the local mayors in Brussels always have an eye to the supranational institutions in their city, not least because, you know, they'll have, you know, the business kind of local economy will be dependent on them. And I'm sure they, you know, I'm sure they thought they were doing their friends down the road a favor.
Yeah, no, for sure. I'm just drawing attention to what is actually more your point about the kind of Europeanization of national polities, right? So it's not like the EU is the EU over there in Brussels and it's these buildings or these structures, but it's something that it becomes part of nation states, like as they become member states. Anyway, but yeah, no, I think, as you say, it's fully kind of mainstream politics, and it makes me question what the nature of the transformations that will happen as a process continues, one that we've discussed, which is to say that as kind of national populists or national conservatives or whatever they're, you want to call them, become increasingly part of, you know, part of the furniture, part of the regular alternation of political parties as they've become, you know, Italy, again, perfect example, where it's like just constantly flipping between some technocratic government come to rescue things and some populist government, which is the latest outrage, and the cycle goes on. Like that's becoming the kind of model of politics in the way that center left, center right alternation used to be for throughout the 20th century. Like if they're, you know, willing to shut down kind of main conference of the right side of that, right? The kind of the populists versus the technocrats. What is that? I mean, is that going to be a short-lived thing? Because increasingly as the kind of national conservatives become incorporated into the regular kind of running of European politics and indeed Western politics, how does that work? You know, like it like what I mean is that like it'll become normal. I think it'll become normalized. Whereas in the US, I think you still have something much more kind of dramatic that happens in the shift between the Democrats and the Republicans, for all that they collectively form the kind of American ruling class and represent the American ruling class collectively. So I don't know. Kind of ill-formed thoughts here, but
I'm not sure I kind of see the contrast with the States so clearly. But in terms of how it plays out in Europe's future, I mean, it seems to me like it redounds to the benefit of the populace still. It is this kind of bizarre choreography because on the one hand, you know, they can claim, you know, as you made the piece you made this point, Alex, in the unheard response to the crackdown on the two conferences, you made this point, but like they, you know, it gives more legitimacy to their claims, the fact that they're seen to be so threatening. I mean, what struck me also was about it was billed as a sovereigntist conference. defending the sovereignty of the nation state was supposed to be the theme of a lot of the program of the NatCon conference, but none of it is about the practicalities of breaking up the European Union or seceding from the European Union.
Mm.
And so that seems to me to suggest it's heading the NAT, you know, which was, I mean, we've made this point before, but it seems to me worth saying again, they're heading in the direction of a kind of cultural understanding of sovereignty, which is to say something which is, you know, it's about protecting your national identity or something like that, rather than a project which is associated with the use of political power for specific national purposes.
Yeah, and so that makes it easier on them as well, because yes, then it can be a culture wars mobilization point, and you don't have the, you know, I'm trying to think what the analogy would be, but when you're talking about sovereignty, you know, you're going to be the ones paying the bill politically, i.e. there's no, I don't know, there's no evasion, or there's one fewer evasion. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. So I think that, you know, where does it go? It kind of carries on. The populace will be fortified by the technocratic assault. The technocrats will be on the back foot. They will need to accommodate and adapt. And, you know, this choreography between the two of them, their political interdependence will continue. Not least because the national conservatives are clearly completely unserious about leaving the European Union or breaking it up or about sovereignty itself. So nothing, I don't think it will kind of change the rhythm of European politics in any kind of meaningful way. It only shows that this pattern is deepening, I think.
No, absolutely. I guess the point is, when do we all, you know, acknowledge that this is theater, right? That this is that, and that the kind of dressing up will, you know, maybe the costumes will change, but that the what's going on remains the same.
Is it the same stage? Are there the same props?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Is it the same play? To extend the theater analogy.
I don't know if I can
extend
the dramaturgical analogy. It's just pantomime. Far, but yeah.
Yeah, that sort of theater, perhaps.
Well, yeah, but anyway, I think in the interest of being kind of ahead of things, I think it's important maybe then to restate this, the fact that it's like, okay, hang on, let's not get wrapped up into this drama. You know, to the extent that one could talk, you know, a decade ago about, you know, populists challenging the kind of order. Now we can see that, you know, how much this has been incorporated, which is something that we've discussed before, but I think it's worth continuing to make that point, and also to explore how it evolves. Right. Because there's obviously no kind of progressive or radical kind of politics that kind of emerge from this, at least from that kind of interface between technocracy and populism. Anyway, so let's move on to your questions and comments, which and indeed criticisms that we've received over the past period. We've actually it's been a little while since we've done this. We're going to try to do these more regularly, and also use it as an opportunity to discuss kind of current affairs. So that's what we're going to try to do forward.
We're going to do these more regularly. We're not.
Yes.
We're not going to try to. We're going to do it.
Yes.
Do good. Or do not. There is no try, as a wise man once said.
You know, that was the line for Elizabeth Holmes, the you know, the con woman who set up Theranos. She was very fond of the Yoda quote, George.
Well, George is very fond of her. George really fancies her. George has this whole thing about her.
It's one of these things where, like, if you dream, people want to, like, cut you down to size. If your dream is, I can do a blood test with one drop of blood for everything, which is, like, physically impossible, so the scientists say, then people just try and, like,
but if you have enough venture capital money, it's fine. You can kind of just kick the can down the road for at least, you know, 10, 15 years.
I might start wearing a black roll-up turtleneck and deepen my voice, which apparently she did.
I always thought
more
you needed
gravitas. I could be the innovation expert on the podcast.
You did need a deeper voice, George. It's quite kind of, you
people
know,
like my voice.
It's quite fey and high-pitched. It would be good to try the Elizabeth Holmes thing.
Well, let us know, listener. This will be the subject, obviously, of the next Alpha Bonus. We discuss the timbre of George's voice. Anyway, so we are still in the midst of doing a series of discussions, a series of episodes called Emotion Sickness, The Politics of Feelings. And we're going to start with your comments on these episodes. So far, just to catch you up, we've had the most recent one has been with Catherine Liu on melodrama. We have discussed my piece about the withdrawal and disengagement from politics and the affects involved in the kind of post-populist decade. We've discussed mental health, resilience, and happiness with Ashley Frawley. And we have discussed anger and evil with Nina Power. So we're going to take some of your questions and comments on these that we've received. We're going to start with these kind of these sets of episodes. And also we will have one big finale, I hope. We should be having Eva Illouz on in the next month. Very excited about that. So, you know, watch this space. Very excited to discuss. She has a book out on the affect of populism, but a whole range of other stuff. And I think, you know, in doing this series and these episodes, I think she's been this kind of constant presence in terms of her writing and work. So, and it's also something that we've done in the reading club before. So very excited to have her on. That'll be, I think it'll should come out late May, I believe. So look out for that. Right. So we're going to start with episode 399, which was the episode we did discussing my essay in the second issue of Damage. Ian Hunter, directed at Phil, are you doing an idealism, boys, or at least an introspective psychoanalytic onanism? Surely a material reason nobody is having a 12-pound sourdough sandwich in Fitzrovia after work, Phil, has to do with mortgage, weekly shop, energy bills all doubling. This is because Phil said that he would go out after work at, you know, around UCL in central London, and things would be much more empty than they used to be. Phil, you're doing an idealism.
I'm a bit bamboozled by this comment, to be honest, because I didn't think it was an idealistic point at all. It was what I was saying was, you know, it's the effect of lockdown kind of choking off those small businesses, and also the effect of telecommuting, right? The fact that people will be working from home now will kind of gradually gouge out the center of London, and it will return, I think, probably over time to its 1970s status, where the core of the city was less populated and much less lively. So my understanding of the point was entirely kind of materialistic, changing structure, the changing result of technology and changing urban demography and so on. So I'm not really sure what Ian was getting at, but maybe you can clarify in a follow-up.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, materialism isn't just about how much money you have in your pocket, I would say.
Well, I presume our listener gets that too. So yeah. maybe the point wasn't well made. So, you know, hopefully it's clearer now.
So one thing about, so the essay is kind of premised on, you know, reactions to hyperpolitics, reactions to the constant sharing of articles, tweeting, you know, rancorous arguments, breaking down into kind of friend-enemy distinctions, etc. Eli S. points out, because in the episode that we did, we referred to episode 365 with Ryan Zickraff, It's So Over. It's worth checking out that episode. But Eli S. points out that that episode came out on the 3rd of October, 2023. 4 days after announcing the end of hyperpolitics, a war broke out and plunged the world into even deeper hyperpolitics, which I think is a point well taken, I think.
Yeah, it's a great point. I think I'd agree with Eli about that kind of overall assessment of the consequences of the Gaza war, at least outside of the region itself.
Yeah. I mean, it also seems to me that, I think, you know, a point that we've maybe hinted at before, but a lot of left-wing attention has now been, and not just left-wing attention, because of course the whole world is horrified by the ongoings in Gaza, but to a certain extent that's providing fuel for left politics, which is otherwise disoriented after left populism. So, you know, there can be a lot of energy put into calling for a ceasefire, justifiably, absolutely. But then after that, you know, what next? And I think that there will be that reckoning at some point, probably towards the end of this year. Unless, of course, it develops into a regional war, in which case we're all fucked. And that'll be a whole other question to deal with, I think. But anyway, a longer question here, which I wanted to deal with because I think it's quite interesting. Justin O'Connor says, Alex's account of hypermodernity and how capitalism extracts from the institutions of social life, that is to say, cannibalizing the social foundations of things like health and education, this can be applied to culture as public policy, which in many ways was neoliberalism's first privatization. Culture is also a sphere in which many have sought to carve out a space of time. Martin Hegelin's vision of using the time of our lives obviously underscores the popularity of UBI, of universal basic income, within the cultural sector. The idea is there, like, not so much that you quit work, but you quit work that makes it impossible to do art, right? So you get your UBI, and instead, so you get your fixed whatever, 10, 15 grand a year, and then you can go off and do art in your time. You're not so dedicated to just staying alive, basically. But more generally, there's a shift to art or culture as providing that breathing space in which some kind of recuperation is possible. Not just Adorno's sense of having some rest before having to go back to work, but a space in which the future might be envisaged. What I find interesting in Alex's final comments about national holidays or national service, which was an idea which I mooted, about carving out time and to all be together at the same time and to kind of put an interruption, at least partially, to the kind of infinitely accelerating kind of circuits of capital and work and whatever. So what I find interesting, Alex's comments about that, is how this can be a sort of radicalized version of the job guarantee as applied to culture, in which collective projects might be envisaged, not just the hyper individualized vision of the basic income people. So that there's some, I assume Justin O'Connor is hinting at some sort of collective state-led project around culture. So one of the core definitions of culture is one of ritual and collective development, one which the Renaissance and Enlightenment tried to radicalize. It is one the right have appropriated and one the left has typically dismissed as elitist or as middle class, when it should precisely be thinking about what a collective culture might look like. I think that's, I think there's a lot to take from that. I don't know how to leverage that into a politics today, right? But I also agree that it's not something that we should be shying away from. I mean, this is also something that we discussed, we touched on in an episode which we recorded yesterday, but you won't be hearing, listener, until the following week after this is out, with Dino Guastella, about kind of social breakdown and about what the role of the left or the progressive force or whoever you might conceive yourself as being part of, what role we have in trying to reconstitute society, because that's not something the left has ever had to really consider. There's a kind of taken for grantedness of society. Now you go, well, we're all broken up into atoms. How much is it our job to sew it all together?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I thought of when I think it's a really good comment from Justin. And yeah, this idea of a public philosophy of sociality, that's the way Dino put it, which I think was bang on the money. Like, what does a collective culture look like? Well, in at the moment, we don't even have the very basic precursors. We don't even really have the idea that a collective culture would be a good thing. I think instead it's a lot of as you said, Alex, atomized individuals, a lot of micro cultures, and that's that isn't a particularly propitious starting point for any kind of left-wing politics or anything like that.
I mean, there's another point about that Justin O'Connor makes. I want to bring this in because we republished just on the Patreon episode 59 from way back in, I guess, 2019 or something like that, 2018, Uber Mention of Capital, where we discussed Lee Phillips and Michal Rosorsky's book,
The Republic of Walmart.
Yeah. The People's Republic of Walmart. That's it. About socialist planning. And Justin O'Connor kind of takes, in commenting on that episode, which we just put up on the Patreon because I wanted to create collections on there. So now we've got all the series that we've done or things that kind of hang together as collections on the Patreon. So if you want to go look at that, that's kind of cool. There's that one on Uber Mention of Capital. We've got the Kali Bunga series on there. We've got the Politics of Feelings, which is still ongoing, Generations, etc. So just a gesture at that. In the comments on that re-released episode, Justin O'Connor does make a point that that we might accept, sort of planning in sectors like steel, water, electricity, but all the shiny, bright colored stuff of kind of consumer commodities, which is really in large part also part of the culture industry, is something that you know, we are resistant to planning on, right? Because that would be, in fact, that's the good stuff of capitalism as we understand it, because that's like capitalism's ability to cater to our every desire. And we don't want socialist planning in culture. But Justin points out that 6 out of the 10 largest global corporations distribute and often produce this culture. So, you know, whether that's Amazon and Amazon doing Amazon Prime or Netflix and all this kind of stuff, there is a huge concentration of capital and centralization of capital when it comes to the production of culture too. Which, of course, in, to a certain degree is a long story because, you know, Hollywood has existed for 100 years. But there's, I think the recent digitalization of culture has accentuated that process, and particularly as so much culture takes place and is distributed across platforms. Hello, you're listening to a podcast. This is also part of it.
If only we were the Uber mention of culture, we could become like the
right
Netflix. Just one quick point on this. I heard a couple of interesting things about Netflix specifically recently. One, that the Netflix CEO had said a few years ago that they're not competing with other streaming services. They're competing, or at the margins, our competitor is sleep. So this is one of the things that this kind of overproduction, as Justin puts it, of culture, you know, creates. And the second is, and I think this is true, although I don't have any evidence for it, that apparently the next wave of kind of mass-produced streaming content is going to be a lot simpler to follow, because turns out a lot of people watch Netflix, Disney Plus, Amazon Prime Video, whatever, with their phones. So you need it to be simple enough so that people can follow along whilst streaming on their phone. So it's kind of, you know, the overproduction of culture, and then the overproduction of that, because people are consuming, you know, we're not just consuming culture, we're consuming, I don't know what the equivalent would be, eating two meals at the same time. Like people are, you know, always like scrolling on their phone in addition to watching a film at the cinema, watching TV at home. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, this is a massive topic which we can't resolve now, but I think just a gesture at a question which we might want to return to at some point. The centralization, you know, the way that kind of cultural production is so monopolized, or at least the platforms of distribution, whatever, it's so oligopolized, is that to take the answer that, you know, Michael and Lee suggest in their book in terms of submitting that to democratic planning is something that, you know, generally we would be reluctant to. I think a lot of people wouldn't be interested in hearing about, you know, because it sounds like, oh, the state is going to provide you with culture, and that sounds fucking terrible, right? For good reason. People are very resistant to that, in a way that, you know, the state providing you water and electricity sounds totally fine. So I think that would maybe be the wrong way to approach this question. Probably the right way would be to think a little bit more bottom up about kind of what kind of culture we want and what would provide the possibilities for kind of free cultural production. But anyway, that's a whole big discussion, which we're not going to do right now. Maybe something to return to. Right. So moving through, we did episode 389 and part of that series on the politics of emotion with Ashley Frawley. Eli S. comments that, because I made a joke at the start of that about the big S, a mishearing of mine, someone referring to the big S subject, which I misheard as the big ass subject. And Eli S says, I listened all the way through this, and the topic of the big ass subject remained in the gendered frame that never raised the question of the big dick subject. Well, ha, our latest episode has remedied that.
I'm back, Eli. It's okay. So it's fine. Don't worry.
You weren't even part of that episode. What do you know?
That's what I'm saying. I'm back. He doesn't need to worry. I'm back. The big dick subject is back. Relax, Eli.
We'll more of this probably at the next Alpha Bonus as we respond to your comments on the episode about big dicks, penis anxiety, and so on. Anyway, so Richard R. took issue with Ashley's critique of mental health as a quote-unquote totalizing concept. I mean, that's in Ashley's presentation of it. Richard R. says that we should take mental health just as sort of naturally as we take physical health. It's no good being like critical of mental health as an idea. Instead, it'd be better to talk about the relationship between freedom and mental health. So, for example, the freedom to have bad health is probably a better place to start than claiming that doctors made up bodies to sell wounds. George, I'm sure you have thoughts on this.
Yeah, very much so. I think it's a good point. This inherent illness paradigm, which we've talked about before on the podcast, is is just so pervasive. Like, we are encouraged to think of ourselves as, you know, mentally and physically unwell, as already having been damaged, as always ill or on the borderline at the very least. So I think there is, you know, I don't think Ashley was saying that the idea of the body, you know, came about culturally in order to sell, you know, to sell pills and sell medicine. But certainly it is the case today that without medical intervention, it doesn't really seem that we can be, you know, we can be safe, we can be whole, we can be well. There's always a pharmaceutical, particularly, requirement to kind of get to the next level. So I think I probably do agree with Ashley and not Richard R. that mental health, physical health, they are totalizing concepts. They do refer to the entirety of a human life, not just the periods of illness or the periods of health. They're, you know, we're always unwell. We're inherently ill, as we discussed when we talked with Ben.
Isn't that premised on a, you know, a negative concept? I mean, that we would traditionally we would maintain a negative conception of health. That is to say, you're kind of healthy unless you're unhealthy, right? And that can apply to mental health. That, like, everyone's kind of, which I actually happen to think isn't the right answer on mental health either. But one could have a conception of mental health where, like, people are more or less okay unless you have a serious mental illness. Of course, what's crept in now is a positive notion of mental health, where everyone's kind of ill unless you have kind of, you are positively, you know, have wellness or whatever, yeah, and are doing all these practices of wellness, which is obviously problematic, or is particularly problematic.
I would say, like, it's the default. The default is now that we're ill, not that we're well. And in fact, that you can never really be well, because you could always be healthier. And because you can always be healthier, you're never healthy. So I think it's just I've written on this, and we've talked about this a lot on the podcast. It is it's part and parcel of people devaluing the human and finding ways to kind of pick apart what we are, what we can do. And I think, you know, this is one of many. So I'm not saying this is exactly what Richard was saying, but I think Ashley made quite a few good points in that episode on this area, I would say.
I'm still not entirely convinced on that, but maybe come back to that. I did like Catherine's answer on this. I mean, kind of psychoanalysis as a good critique and response to therapy culture, rather than seeing it as being complicit in it. Anyway, but there's more to be discussed there, and no doubt we'll come back to it. And I know you listeners tend to be quite interested in these subjects every time we've dealt with them. I'm from back when we did the California series through to now. So there'll be more of this. One final set of comments on the series on emotion sickness, episode 393 with Nina Power. John Rorden points out, because we discussed Hannah Arendt in that episode, that kind of crept up, and her conception of evil and the banality of evil. So John comments, Arendt thought the most dangerous and anti-political emotion was love, basically because it breeds an irrational loyalty, clouds political judgment, and prevents thought, leading to the banal, mechanical evil of Eichmann. I think it's an under-discussed explanation for our hyper-emotional Schmittian moment, more so than hatred is. I'll take another comment here.
I just thought this was a particularly good comment from John. It just made me think of, like, the politics of free love, and, like, how it was not to do particularly with political projects. It was just a general effective attachment to good things. And maybe there is a legacy there where now we are not induced to kind of support political projects as much as have the right effective orientation to politics, perhaps. I don't know.
Sure, I don't think that has anything to do with love.
I think it does. You know, you see these signs everywhere, just like live, love, laugh.
Yeah, but that's not love.
All we need is love.
But that's just like love.
Love wins, right? The kind of the slogan of the kind of LGBTQ movement, love wins, and the campaigning around gay marriage, love not hate, right? It's always cast as our problems are the politics of hate, with the implication being that we need more kind of kindness and affection and love ultimately, I guess. I mean, it's an intriguing thought from John. I'm not I suppose I'm unsure of it because it's, you know, so much of Hannah Arendt stuff comes from this nostalgia for the ancients, I think, in contrast to the moderns. And so there's always a certain kind of, I think, some kind of snootiness on her part towards modern politics, which doesn't necessarily help us.
What sort of love is it? Eros, is it agape? There's a few more.
Well, she talks about, you know, she does talk about it quite a bit, about the different kinds of love, and but she does, I mean, John is right, she treats it as very, as this kind of stultifying impact on political life. I had a PhD student who did some work on this and was kind of offered a critique of Arendt in favor of Hegel's understanding of love, because Hegel gave a great gave great prominence to the significance of love, not in the public realm so much, but in the private realm, but in the sense that love was necessary, was a necessary component of the private realm, but which was necessary to, in order to kind of construct the public realm, and was sublimated into the public realm through the love, through private love. And so there was a kind of there is an alternative to thinking about love in the context of modern politics that doesn't just require it to be kind of repressed or cast out from the lexicon of talking about public life and society in modernity. Anyway, I mean, I'm not pretending to have any kind of coherent answer, because I think it is a good spot on John's part, and there is some genuine, probably some work to be done there even, about understanding how this kind of the injunction to be more loving, how that plays out in current politics.
Yeah, I mean, for me that seems like not a claim for passion or effusive emotion or abandon to deep love and connection, but seems to be a constraining of emotions, you know, about saying like of stipulating a certain emotional correctness. So I think there's probably a lot of layers to unpick there. An interesting comment kind of along similar lines, Ricardo Gisilo says, it seems that the left has a problem acknowledging they are an antagonizing force, and they will be met with force on the other side, disproportional force. That's not evil. The old left understood this. They would have had one or two tricks up their sleeves to show the police, you know, Marighella style. I think it's a reference to a communist militant in Brazil in the 1960s who was assassinated on the streets of São Paulo. But anyway, that the left is also not righteous. It's politics, not a holy war. They seem to be all the time outraged by how others don't behave the way they expected. Then they get broken to the point that they need to resort to the safety of absolute evil from monotheism. I think this is right. If I understand Ricardo's point, is that there's a kind of a post-political presumption on the part of the left that they're proposing good ideas which should be agreed with, and when they're not agreed with and they're met with repression, for example, that this is an evil on the part of the ruling class rather than being the nature of politics, of conflict. One last comment on this. It was kind of a discussion in which Nina Power responded on the Patreon. If you want to see the full kind of discussion there, you can do that. Anurin was kind of critical of Nina somewhat indirectly, but says that the phenomenon of those cast out of left-wing milieus who then adopt right-wing ideas is kind of exemplified, I think he suggests, I think, by Nina. People's politics are defined in reaction to certain social or interpersonal dynamics, and that is stupid. I'd take them more seriously if they turn to art as an escape rather than a political project as equally pointless and degenerate as the one that they left. So this, I think, is, you know, I mean, if that isn't clear to specify, I think he's suggesting that someone like Nina, who was, you know, heavily canceled, I guess, by the left, and that then, you know, Anurin alleges that this had an impact on their politics, basically, and they think that this is stupid in terms of, you know, then adopting right-wing ideas or something. Nina replied that she or they, it's some collective that she refers to, are actually trying to create a new culture, starting small. And Yuren retorts that, I appreciate the positivity, but the quote-unquote we here is the exact same noxious PMC types that made up the Corbyn left. I don't see how them being a bit culturally right-wing will make any difference. You can already see them exhibiting the same pathologies. Finally, Eli chips in with, being cast out of left-wing milieu should in fact make you rethink the proposition that utopia is built on giving your milieu unopposed political power to bureaucratically allocate material goods according to social status, something that quite large proportions of the left continue to uphold.
I think Nina is more than capable of defending her own position, as is evident in this exchange with the other listener here. The only thing I would say, I don't see that being forced to reconsider one's basic ideas as a result of what happens politically in the world, that doesn't seem to me to be a bad thing at all. And obviously you might end up kind of heading in the wrong direction or making mistakes, but the effort to reassess and reevaluate your position in response to the actual results of political experience, that seems to me entirely healthy and should be encouraged, even, I'd say.
I think all other things being equal, this might sound like a very what would the word be, not unsympathetic, but like, all other things being equal, being cancelled would surely improve your like political judgment, because all of these fetters of like your friends or these people who think the same thing as you, who give you a reason to think this thing, even though it might, or this kind of philosophical position, if you just had all of those things stripped away, you would be able to, with sober senses, kind of calmly assess what's going on. So
getting dangerously close to saying you have good politics when you have no friends, which
the more friends you have, the worse your politics might be, because you'll be influenced by all of these.
That runs entirely counter to just what we were saying about antisociality. But
maybe. I just wanted to try something out. I thought this was a discussion.
No, so I would say that one of the problems here is class politics. Class politics, we should just have ideas, not class politics. I'm being provocative, but I think there's a lot of phony class politics that goes on here, which is what Ayn Rand is gesturing at, which is to say this idea that like, aha, that's all the PMC. I'm now with these other people who have this exact same class basis or whatever. Ultimately, we're talking about small groups of people where it doesn't necessarily make too much sense to talk in like kind of class terms or whatever. Ultimately, these are about ideas and saying, well, I think these ideas are right or these ideas are wrong, or there's a good idea. These ideas might be a good basis on which to build politics or not. Right. So I think the idea that like, oh, well, these are all the PMC leftists who are terrible versus the other people who are against that, who are the same PMC, except that they're post-liberals or whatever. You know, I don't think there's any politics in that. And there's a lot of gesturing, or rather posturing, I should say, in that, which doesn't really have much foundation. And I think Nina is cognizant of that. She's like, I'm not pretending anything else. I'm just saying, you know, like, I'm just trying to build a new culture based on these ideas, because the kind of noxious cancel culture stuff advanced by the kind of quote unquote progressives is a complete dead end. And I think that's right. And I think we can proceed from that basis. Moving on to episode 401. So we're kind of jumping around here, but now we're moving from front to back from the most recent one. We had a very well-received episode, not very many comments, but people really enjoyed it, it seemed, the episode with Roger Lancaster on homosexuality in Mexico, struggles and development and much else besides. Someone just commented on the version of the joke with which we started that episode. It used to be that you had to be handsome and rich. Now they just let anyone be gay. There's lots of iterations, I think, of the
similar
sort of joke.
Still time for you two guys to come out then, so it's fine. So
that wouldn't make any sense. But anyway.
Lame.
Yeah, 400th anniversary episode, where we had all our new regular contributors, Catherine, Alex, Lee, and Amber, together to discuss a whole range of themes, from the kind of incorporation of right populism, which is where we started this episode here, all the way through to the role of images and artificial intelligence, which is the subject of some of the discussion that goes on. Just before that, though, Daniel Kelly makes an interesting point, which I want to unpick a little bit. Here we are still arguing about China, Russia, capitalism, socialism, Israel, Palestine. Forget whether neoliberalism is over or not. It seems the long 20th century shows no sign of ending anytime soon. So I'm like fascinated by this.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought, right? I mean, it's kind of, it would package up and kind of flatten out the one of the central claims of this podcast about the end of history. So perhaps I'm biased, but the big difference is, right? I mean, partly you could say the polarities are reversing, right? So the 20th century, or at least the second half of the 20th century, was China and Russia against each other, whereas now China and Russia are kind of increasingly aligned against America and its allies. Israel-Palestine, the polarities are reversing, it seems to me, in significant ways, in terms of increasing Western sympathy for the Palestinians, even American sympathy for the Palestinians. Not overwhelming and sudden. I know people will leap on what I'm saying, but, you know, it seems to me that's the general direction, is that we're losing the basis on which Israel-Palestine politics has been conducted over the second half of the 20th century is being flipped. We're going through that kind of reverse of polarity. But the main thing is capitalism, socialism, right? Socialism, there isn't anyone who can claim to be stand for socialist politics. That's just true. So...
Yeah, no, I think the thing about the 20th century, and this is a point that I want to kind of hammer home, but like the we are in the throes of the ending of the 20th century, and not just, as I've said before, not just its content, but its forms. And so many of the institutions which we take for granted that developed in the 20th century, or indeed even in the 19th century, are collapsing. What journalism and the media is, what the university has come to be, the role of political parties, the conflict between left and right, all these things are falling apart. And what we're left with is a kind of zombie politics. It's kind of, or zombie institutions or zombie forms that still seem like or look like a lot of the things that existed in the 20th century, but increasingly, again, are either hollowed out or collapsing themselves as forms. And I think that Daniel Kelly's point actually points to this very well. We're still talking about China, Russia, but what do China and Russia mean nowadays? You know, China is not the kind of, it's not a force of Maoism and the revolt of the peasantry or the national movements, right? It's the coming, if not the coming hegemon, certainly the kind of the largest power to challenge the United States. Russia is this kind of decrepit neo-reactionary power. It's not the Soviet Union. Israel, Palestine, the polarities maybe are shifting. So these are all kind of, in some ways, sort of farcical or very confused or scrambled versions of the past that are kind of ghosts of the 20th century, which still kind of float around, and we think we're still doing the same thing when actually it's all kind of completely transformed or reoriented. So, death to the 20th century, I guess, is my point. The faster we can accelerate that process, the better. To take the other questions on this, the 400th anniversary episode, the others relate, I think, to image. So Vera Kwan says, very interesting group and a truly much appreciated post-Bernie, post-Corbyn, maybe post-populism discussion. However, as Catherine Liu is older than the rest of you, please step back and realize that she's seen more of life generationally, whether the new thing everyone may be angsting upon now is quite often a rerun for those of us who are older and have seen it all before. Give Catherine a bit more room. She's really funny and observant. Thanks for that comment, Catherine. Obviously.
I was going to say it's good advice, and I can speak as somebody who's, you know, a bit grayer in the beard, a bit wiser, a bit seen a bit more life than the other two young pups on the podcast. So I think it's a good comment, Catherine, and I would welcome it and encourage it.
I'm sure that's not Catherine, actually, but who knows? It might be. But anyway, Vera Kwan may be objecting to me shutting Catherine down when we needed to move on. But you know, we needed to keep that episode under 2 hours because I think it's. Anything longer that's any episode or like stream or something that's longer than 2 hours is just masturbatory and should be avoided, I think.
Masturbatory?
That sounded weird. Masturbatory?
Speaking English, Alex.
Masturbatory? Onanistic? There we go.
Onanistic is
it's one of these psychoanalytic introspective onanisms that we've been charged with.
That's right.
Yeah.
For 2 hours. That's quite
but you know, there's like these people who do these streams, like they did this 5-hour stream debate on Israel Palestine, right? With that guy Destiny.
Is that gooning?
it's intellectual gooning, yeah.
Did they solve it 5 hours? If we kept going for another, you know, 4 hours, yeah. We could have solved what the politics of the next decade is going
to
be.
But like, look, debates are very important. Podcasts are good. It allows you to discuss these things and to present issues and to consume it in a more passive form. But if you're going to do that for like 3, 4, 5 hours, like just go fucking read a book. You know, you're going to get more bang for your buck reading a book than listening to like a 5-hour live stream.
That'd be true for every other podcast apart from ours. Obviously, you will.
Well, but we have self-discipline. We don't do episodes that are like 3 hours long for good reason. But
that's a choice. That's an artistic choice. So I'm just saying to our listeners.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a film, right? You know, it's about the editing, it's about the pacing, it's about the story you want to tell. So,
we
could become Scorsese.
These things have no editing. That's the point. You know, these 3-hour, 4-hour long things are just people talking. There's no editing going on there. That's the issue.
But yeah, right? But what George is saying that if we did it, we would edit it. That's the point.
Right. Exactly. So we've done a 5-hour long series. That's true.
We could do Scorsese podcasting, but we choose not to. But if we did, obviously, listeners, it would be great.
One of the longest films I've ever watched is actually called The End of History, and it's about kind of the Philippines. It's a fictionalized story. It's called I've forgotten the name, but it's like 4 hours long, and I made my wife sit through it, and she hated me for it and fell asleep. Anyway, Pier Paolo Tamburelli says, the talk is nice and some points very interesting, but Catherine Liu's rant against images is altogether rather dumb. If some sort of new political configuration has to be imagined, then it will need images. I cannot understand why we should be suspicious of all of them without distinction. He cites a painting called The Fourth Estate by Petzila, which people will be familiar with, it, even if they don't recognize me mentioning it. It was used, I think, as like kind of the cover of Bertolini's Novecento, I think, right? Like the film, I mean, with Gérard Depardieu and stuff. If George can bring it up, for those who are watching, you can see it. But anyway, it's like it's some peasants, three peasants walking kind of more in the foreground, and then a whole bunch of them in the background. It's famous. Famous painting from the early 20th century into the 19th century.
Also on the cover of 100 Years of Socialism, the West European Left in the 20th Century by Donald Sassoon, which I have a copy of and may have read some of. Probably one of those books where I've read the first 20 pages, lots of underlining, and then couldn't read all of it.
So, I mean, well, on images, Richard R. says that the problem with the image is that it's impossible to argue with. Architecture, you can just break or disobey. Poetry and fiction, you can literally argue with. An image or sculpture is just what it is. I don't know enough of kind of aesthetic theory.
Well, the
and
Taliban,
all that stuff.
I disagree, I could say.
That's true, actually. Good point, yeah.
Well, I just to give a shout out to...
Like all those statue pullers, like, you know, what is that all about, right?
Yeah. The Camille Paglia book,
like, is a thing, like it has a long history.
Yeah, but anyway, the Camille Paglia book, Glittering Images, which I read recently after it was recommended by a listener, is brilliant on this. I was extremely impressed by her writing and verve and her analysis of these particular images. I kind of wish I'd read it before we did that episode so I could have engaged.
What does she have to say about images? Pro or anti?
Just that we live in a world that's saturated by images. You don't have a sophisticated way of analyzing images as you do analyzing literature. So she kind of says, look, if you want to do art history, you can just get 80 projector slides and just put them up, and that's how you should do it, because we do live in a world which is completely dominated by the image, and unless you know that, you know, how to read them, what they mean, what the symbols are within them, you will not be able to fully grasp the kind of the language, the visual, or no, not the visual, but just the, like the dominant language of contemporary society. So yeah, very good book.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe something to return to. Listener, if you're interested in debating more about the kind of world, kaleidoscopic world of images that we live in, let us know. Just a quick note, comments in response to the reading club are dealt with in the reading club. So, you know, keep it close knit and walled off, and join us if you'd like to. Actually, you have another 2 days. I don't, maybe this will be out by then. But year long subscribers to the Reading Club, have a chance of winning a BungaCast t-shirt. So we're going to do that raffle really soon. We so far have done in the Reading Club, Benedict Anderson's Imagined Communities, and we've done, Jürgen Habermas's re-up on, The Public Sphere, a book that he's just come out with, last year about, you know, what social media is and how it impacts what the public sphere is. And then coming up very soon, we have biographies of Stalin and of Zhurkov, Stalin's general, you know, the Second World War, as part of our kind of examinations of Russia. We're also going to have another book on the contemporary structure Zhurkov. Of Russian politics.
Zhurkov, Alex. Zhurkov, not Zhurkov.
I didn't say Zhurkov.
It's pronounced Zhurkov.
You're thinking Zhurkov. Zhurkov, yeah. Anyway, whatever. So that's all coming up. Please join us if you'd like to, because we're exploring three different themes over kind of this period of the Reading Club, which is to say Russia, past and present, the relationship between the intelligentsia and the public, and the rise and fall of nations, which I think is really important. So I'm looking forward to continuing with that. Please join us there. Winding towards the end here, the episode with Benjamin Studebaker, 395, which was part of an ongoing discussion about left populism. There's been lots of kind of retrospectives about what left populism was. I had a review essay. There's been lots of other writings reviewing recent books on this. We've talked about on this podcast with Anton Yeager, with Vincent Bevins, with Chris Cutrone. And this was kind of part of that discussion. We discussed specifically the role of the internet and media, which lots of people disliked, I think. Lots of people were critical of this episode. There's a discussion about who killed the millennial left, right? And I think people understood Benjamin Studebaker as blaming millennials, or rather blaming older Gen Xers. Eli points out, I think there's a different Eli from Eli S, but it was actually a generational inside job. So it wasn't Gen Xers at fault. Rather, the dividing line may have been college versus non-college. So, you know, kind of the college educated screwed over the non-college educated. T.A. says, as an 80s kid who vividly remembers Gen X leftism, I was surprised to learn we were the social justice warriors who put the millennial materialists in their place. Blake comments that the idea of a millennial left as dominated by a very specific generational segment that, quote unquote, thinks in text and attributes an undue political significance to think pieces is something that never occurred to me before, but makes a lot of sense. Various comments pointed out that this was too American or too generational in its lens. Jonas Kiratsis pointing out that, yes, the internet was better for a while. Better spaces for discourse existed, and it may have deluded people into thinking something better could be built, but it also wasn't that much better. These illusions need to be dealt with much more harshly if we're going to learn anything from these debacles. And several were critical of Benjamin for claiming that early millennials were the last good writers or more text-based, and that the internet was better then. I do want to kind of defend Benjamin Studebaker here, because I think these comments have to be taken in context. I don't think he was advancing a general theory of why the millennial left failed and putting it all down to internet and media. It was more of a kind of addendum to a lot of the other discussions which I've already gestured at, and saying actually, but there was a conception of using kind of the text-based internet to pursue politics, right? To communicate ideas and whatever, which has now been superseded by much more video and image-based media. I don't know if you guys have any comments on that. I think there's also like the, I think every time we talk about generations, people are like, wow, generations are bullshit. Like, yeah, we know, we did a whole fucking series about why generations are bullshit. Okay. So we know this. We're starting from that, from the premise that generations are bullshit, but and certain times it's useful to refer to them either as a shorthand or because they genuinely bookend traditions or kind of phases within a tradition. I think it's worth restating that. Okay, finally, last one. Episode 394, Girls and Boys, about gender differences, gender divergences, particularly in voting behavior, but also in attitudes and values amongst the youngest generation, amongst those 18 to 24 or 18 to 30, which is a global phenomenon. We discuss this with Nina Power, and we're going to come back to discuss it. Richard R. made mention to Korea, saying it's quite a mark there, and we're trying to pull together an episode on this. So watch this space. Hopefully that'll be coming out soon. What's going on in Korea is fascinating in terms of its fertility crisis, big division between kind of feminists and incels, lots of gender strife, fascinating kind of sociological phenomenon and its political consequences. To take these comments, Laurie Franson says, in the party politics of the 50s and 60s in Italy and France, being right-wing meant supporting the socially conservative and paternalistic Christian Democrats, later the Gaullists in France, whereas being left-wing largely meant supporting the Communist Party. The latter is easy to see as the riskier anti-establishment choice, and thus this trend is consistent with well-known average gender difference when it comes to risk-taking and conflict aversion. Nowadays, it's easy to see that tables have turned. Being liberal in the broad sense is the pro-establishment position, and being conservative is the anti-establishment position.
I think it's a really good point, actually. I would never overplay this, the kind of the psychological aspect of the way in which, or let me reframe that. I wouldn't overplay the significance of the psychological predispositions in electoral choices in terms of how it explains or drives politics in its entirety. But in terms of, I think the listener, Laurie here, is bang on about that you can, it's not so mysterious that you can kind of explain the polarity shifting again, as we mentioned before, in this context, in terms of basic masculine, feminine kind of psychological traits that are well established in the literature.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to explore in this issue. And, you know, as I said, I think in that episode, it's something which, because it affects primarily the youngest generation, one wonders whether, as that cohort goes through its life course, whether those differences will continue, right? In which case, like, these gender divisions will become a major factor in politics. So I'm very interested to kind of keep discussing this. There's loads to unpick. Mads Vindel points out that, who's from Denmark, points out this trend is very much emerging in Scandinavia. The past month, it's been extensively debated that young men are increasingly oriented towards the right and young women towards the left. There's so many different ways to analyze this. And the point about risk aversion, I think, is interesting. If women are more risk averse, then they would vote for the quote unquote left nowadays, because that's the more establishment position. But at the same time, if you have more gender equality today, you would presume that the gender polarity of risk aversion versus more risk taking would also even out, right?
So no, it's not, you wouldn't, because the point is, like, if you have more risk aversion and more gender equality, then women will be more likely to support those institutions and forces that they associate with defending their position and success in society, which is the left, right? The liberal left. The other thing I think, which is the only thing which is kind of a fly in the ointment for Laurie Franzen's point here, is that the left is so antinatalist. You know, the traditional argument for the conservative, the way that women tend to be more kind, have voted more conservatively, insofar as you want to give a psychological account of it, it was also the ideas that the conservative party supported the family, and therefore women were concerned with, kind of defending the household and their position in the family and what have you. Whereas now, you know, that's conservatives are kind of trying to claw that territory back as they try and shift away from their pro-free market stance over the last 30, 40 years, whereas the left is, there's no reason to play this down. The left is ferociously, I think, antinatalist, even to the point, I've come across articles in The Guardian where, you know, there's a suggestion that any kind of pronatalism is equivalent to white supremacy and Nazism of some kind. So that, I'm not sure how that quite fits, right? Unless you know, kind of women in their political choices have also kind of are also voting against natalism, you know, and that is kind of baked into their political choices in terms of party voting anyway.
Which they could be, if the idea is that natalism or, you know, childbirth particularly disadvantages women, then a society that expects childbirth could be disadvantaging women. I mean, I'm not saying that's what's happening, but it's possible.
All very interesting. We're going to try to return to this. As I said, we're going to try to do an episode on Korea on this. And in general, I think it's something which will be like a running concern in Western politics. One final comment. Christopher Islin says, a big issue for young men is the lack of positive role models, especially when compared to young women. The discourse around toxic masculinity makes it very difficult to establish and promote positive, quote unquote, male traits, which are not just be more like a woman. The only three models I can imagine existing right now are John Galt, the exceptional individual, figure in
Atlas Shrugged,
Ayn Rand's novel. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Andrew Tate, which is self-explanatory, or Barack Obama, good guy and nice family man.
Andrew Tate is self-explanatory. I mean, you know, like it is, you know, what is the kind of, what is the appeal of, you know, what is the appeal there?
Well, it's masculinist, right? It's like tries to say, yeah, I'm strong, I hustle, I get the bag, and
he's not a provider or protector, you know, and so that, you know, I'm not quite sure. It's kind of the you know, taking one element of what would be seen as a traditional kind of masculine role and kind of exaggerating it at the expense of all the others.
Yeah.
So I mean, the figure that's missing, I think, is the is a father figure. Right. So John Galt is the kind of Ayn Rand's vision of the who doesn't procreate. Right. He kind of, or his progeny is his kind of impact on the world. You have Andrew Tate, who is also, you know, you couldn't imagine him as a kind of, as a meaningful kind of role model as a father. And Barack Obama, who's a liberal weenie. So I don't see him kind of, you know.
Well, he's a family man.
He's a father. But yeah,
I do tend to agree though with your general point, Phil. Although I would say there's another person missing. Like, what about the kind of I don't know, the podcaster as a kind of role model? It's a traditionally male.
It's true.
Activity.
And YouTube guys are definitely failing on that. That the podcast has me to at least offer some kind of role model, male role model, compared to YouTube.
You can
guys.
Imagine all these young men who've grown up and wanting to be like Phil. It would be a terrible generational bit of damage we could do.
Well,
but no, I was thinking
better than YouTube guys. If those are the options,
somebody like Joe Rogan, who's kind of you know, making his millions by just, you know, kind of public intellectual in of a way.
Yeah. Asking
like,
questions.
Honestly,
yeah.
I mean, that's not a kind of completely that's a sort of achievement. I guess there's also sports people as well, who are always role models.
He is kind of a family guy, but I'm not sure a podcaster gets to be a role model, right? I mean, that's the thing, right? It's not particularly somebody who just asks questions and their public persona is based around that role. But I mean, it is an interesting thought.
Tom Cruise is the kind of the greatest action film star, but he is a...
he's a Scientologist and he's weird and creepy and, you know,
exactly.
Like...
So, no, I do take the general point that there doesn't seem to be all that many role models for young men.
Indeed. Anyway, I think we're going to leave this here. If you have any comments on this, of course, I'm sure you'll let us know on the Patreon. Thanks for being with us. As always, we look forward to chatting with you and seeing you very soon. We're going to have what have we got coming up next? Well, we have the episode which we've already mentioned with Dustin Guastella about drugs, social breakdown, and the antisocial socialism. That'll be coming out probably the week after you hear this. Hopefully we get this episode on South Korea together. We're going to be discussing the film Civil War. We have Isaac Deutscher's biography of Stalin and what the relevance of Stalin is today in the reading club. We will also have Eva Luz, as I mentioned, talking about Saudi modernism, I think, with Sam Chris. We're going to be having Simon Reynolds on about his new book, he of Retromania, talking about more future-oriented music, and much else besides. So very excited about what's coming up in the next month. We look forward to seeing you, and thanks for being with us. As always, catch you later. Bye-bye.